السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. So we're continuing with this battle of Ma'adin. So Sa'd radiallahu anhu was dismayed to learn that the emperor had fled. The emperor left the city and ran away. And they fled in ships across the river to the eastern part of the city, and that he had taken all the boats with him. The enemy was right in front of them, but there was a river in between which the Muslims could not cross since they didn't have boats. Sa'd radiallahu anhu feared that the enemy would flee inland, and hence it would be difficult to defeat him decisively. So a group of Persian natives came to him and told him that, see, at a certain point, the river is shallow. So you can cross it, but there will be some danger also. So Sa'd radiallahu anhu rejected this idea and hesitated taking that risk. He said, no. All of a sudden, the river swelled in a giant tide, such that its waters became black and foam due to the speed that it's now moving at. Foam also started developing on the water. During this time, Sa'd radiallahu anhu saw a good dream in which he saw the Muslim cavalry, those on horseback, they crossed the river. He became determined to make his dream come true. Sa'd radiallahu anhu gathered his troops and said to them, first he praised Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then he said to them, your enemy has barricaded himself with this river. You cannot reach them, but they can come across to you in their boats to fight you. There is nothing behind you from where you could fear an attack. The earlier Mujahideen took care of that. They've crippled the entire Persian forces behind you, so we got no fear from the back. They destroyed the wealth which they used to use to fight. So the economy also is crashed, and there's no army now behind you. In my opinion, you should hasten to make your intentions sincere for jihad, and don't get attracted to the worldly pleasures around you. I have decided to cross this river to get to them. The army was unanimous. They said, Allah Ta'ala has guided you to make this resolve, let's do it. Nobody was holding back and saying, no, how can we put ourselves in this danger and all of that. So this narrative contains many lessons for us, right? It shows the support, the help that Allah Ta'ala gives to true believers, right? The true dream that Sa'd radiallahu anhu saw was from Allah Ta'ala to strengthen his heart. If you never see that dream, initially he was thinking it's a danger to cross this river. And Allah Ta'ala showed him that dream, now he had a resolve, you know, we will cross it. And Allah Ta'ala makes things turn in the Muslims' favor. The river's flow became abnormally intense. Now apparently this was advantageous for the Persians, because now to cross the river with this heavy current, this will be worse. Right? However, in reality, it was good for the Muslims. Why? When the Persians saw the river like that, so they now dropped their guard. They said, there's no way these Muslims can cross this river now. We are safe. So they dropped their guard. Sahaba radiallahu anhum used to see a good dream seen by a pious person to be a good sign. And they felt that now if a pious person saw the dream, we need to put this into action. They used to hope for the best from Allah Ta'ala, and they believed that good dreams are from Allah Ta'ala. Muslim leaders in those generations they had a lot of resoluteness. They were firm. And they made use of opportunities. Any opportunity that presented itself, they made use of it, exploiting that opportunity to their advantage. So here Sa'ad radiallahu anhu ordered his men to cross over to the troops, armed with the fear of Allah Ta'ala in their hearts. That was their main weapon, the fear of Allah Ta'ala. He was content with the level of iman in Allah Ta'ala that his troops possessed. Hence he decided to proceed with his plan. First he sought help from Allah Ta'ala, and then he relied on the iman of his troops. The companions and the generation, the tabi'in, the sahaba nonum, the tabi'in, were characterized by complete obedience to their leaders. They used to regard it that this is a fundamental, it's a compulsory thing in our deen. It is a good deed which makes us closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We must listen to the leader. Today's time you find in, whether it's in masajid, whether it's in institutes, whether it's at home, whether it's in a business, there's partners, children in the business. But the main problem is nobody is prepared to listen to the Amir. That's how you get divisions. That's how you get factions. Because now one person feels, no, no, no. Then he starts making ribat. He starts talking to two, three people. Then they form one group. Now you get problems coming. Whether it's in a business, whether it's in a family, whether it's in madrasas, masajid, everywhere. It's the same thing. You're not prepared to listen. In a home also. Problem comes in the whole home because the wife and the children, they don't regard the father as the Amir. And on the other hand, those that are in the positions of Amir, then they are not developing that taqwa, that righteousness, that compassion, etc. They are not developing the akhlaq of an Amir, of a leader. So Sa'ad radiallahu anhu asked for volunteers to cross the river. He said, who will start? So the person, you need one group to start, get onto the eastern shore and create like, you know, a stem, right? Because now, while the Muslims are crossing the water, they're vulnerable. So initially the Persian army won't know that you're crossing, but once few people cross, so now they will know you're crossing, so now they can start raining arrows on you or whatever, so you're vulnerable while you're in the water. So he wanted that one group must go first and have the place protected so that the other group, when they are coming, they got cover. Right? Asim bin Amr Tamimi, this was the brother of Ka'ka. Right? So he was the first one to volunteer. As soon as he volunteered, 600 other mujahideen followed suit. So Sa'ad radiallahu anhu appointed Asim as the commander of this battalion. Asim marched with his men towards their target until he reached the shore, and he reached the shore and he said, who will volunteer with me to cross at the first wave? I'm going to go, somebody else come with me, so that we can protect the rest of our brigade till they cross. The first, the two of us cross quietly, we won't create a din, they won't know that we have crossed, we'll go on the other side. Then the other 598 will come, right? Now when that 598 is coming, it will create a noise, but we will be able to offer them cover while they are crossing. At once, 60 mujahideen volunteered. So together, they went into the river. The rest of the 600 men also came into the water close at their heels. The brigade of 600 mujahideen was called the Shock Brigade. This first brigade that went. 60 of them were chosen by Asim to land as the first wave. This was splendid planning by both Sa'ad radiallahu anhu and then Asim. Since risky and shock operations do not depend upon numbers, instead they should be carried out by mujahideen or warriors having superlative fighting skills, even if they are few. Because if less competent and less brave mujahideen are selected, their flight under enemy attack can lead to defeat. So you rather have few, but they're standing ground and they know what they're doing. The first wave is said to have included Asim bin Wallad Tamimi, Khalaj al-Zabbi, Abu Mufarriz, Sharjil bin Samat al-Kindi, Hajal al-Ijli, Malik bin Ka'b Hamdani, and the youth of the Banu Haris bin Ka'b tribe. As the first wave neared the eastern shore, the Persians realized that now their cavalry has to face the invaders. They were caught unaware, right? The two units met in the river near the shore. Asim shouted, "Take your spears and go for the eyes. Aim for the eyes." The Muslims did just that with their spears, and soon the defenders turned tail towards the shore. Now the Muslims pricked the fleeing horses with their spears, which made them flee wildly without a care of their riders. The invaders caught up with them and killed most of them. The Persian cavalry that remained all had riders with one eye missing from the onslaught. The rest of the brigade came across too and joined now this 60 that had went. So the rest of them now joined them. When Sa'ad radiallahu anhu saw that Asim had accomplished his mission, he said to his army that we seek help from Allah Ta'ala and we put our trust in Allah Ta'ala alone. And he said, "Hasbunallahu wa ni'mal wakil." Allah Ta'ala alone is sufficient for us, and he is the best disposer of affairs. And then, "La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah." There's no power, there's no might except with Allah Ta'ala. Now the bulk of the army plunged into the vast dark river, filled with foam. People were talking to each other while swimming, almost carelessly, as if they were chatting on land. They went through this river like how you're walking on land, talking. Not like they were afraid and watch out for the water and all that. Salman Farsi radiallahu an was next to Saad radiallahu an in the water, wading on horseback. Saad radiallahu an said, "Hasbunallahu wa ni'mal wakil." Allah will indeed help his friends. Allah will make his deen victorious and defeat his enemies. Right? See, this is the maqsad of jihad. To establish the deen of Allah Ta'ala. Today most people that are fighting, they are fighting for their land. They're fighting because they're being oppressed. So not to say you can't fight for those reasons. But if you really want the help of Allah Ta'ala, then you have to fight to establish the deen of Allah Ta'ala. So it's unfortunate that most places, even when they get the land, they don't establish the Shariat. They don't establish Shariat. When they get the land, you see, we suffer from an inferiority complex. Right? So when we get the land, now we want to show the kuffar world that no, we're not so bad. We are an all-inclusive government. Right? No, we're tolerant to everybody. Yeah, see, we also going to establish a democracy. Now, when you say all-inclusive, if you are saying that, look, there are Christians living in our country, so they can live, they can worship, we will not kill them now. There are some Jews living here, they got their synagogue, they are worshipping, fine, no problem. As long as they are all living under our rule, and they are not creating mischief here and causing problems, so then no problem. So if that's the meaning of all inclusive, then no problem, that's fine. But if all inclusive is what is translated by the UAE, that now the government at Christmas time, and what they call Christmas now, is putting up Christmas decorations in the country. They say, no, we've got so many non-Muslim people living in our country, and we've got so many Christian people that are tourists in our country, so now we have to provide wine and swine for them, and we have to put up lights for them. Now, that is not Islam. You are a Muslim country. Why must you allow all these gunas here? If they want to live in our country, then they must live according to our rules, according to our restrictions. We don't allow these things, it can't happen. Right? They are allowed to live in peace. They can do their business, they can do their farming, they can worship, they can build their church, no problem. But they can't come and change the face of the deen now. And then the government is doing it from their side. The government is going to have iftar in the mandir. How can you have that now? So, all inclusive, what does it really mean in today's times? And then to go for democracy now. Now why you go for democracy? Because you need to show the Western world, no, see, it's free and fair elections. We are also a democracy. How can you call us terrorists and all that? So you live under this inferiority complex that I need to prove to the Western world that we also like them. So then that is a waste of time. It's a waste of time. As a mu'min, if Allah Ta'ala gives us a country, we must establish Sharia. Allah gives us a place, we must establish Sharia. And we must start from now. The house Allah Pa gave me, I must establish Sharia there. The business Allah Pa gave me, I must establish Sharia there. The family Allah Pa gave me, I must establish Sharia there. So if I keep doing that, then one day if Allah Ta'ala gives me a village, I can establish Sharia. If Allah Ta'ala gives me a town, I can establish Sharia. Allah gives me a city, Allah gives me a province, Allah gives me a country. What's difficult for Allah Ta'ala? Nothing is difficult for Allah Ta'ala. As soon as you got a place, you establish Sharia. Then you have the Nusrat of Allah. So look at these Sahaba Nanum. How many places they have now conquered, but still their maqsad is one. That we are fighting for the upliftment of the deen, the establishment of the deen of Allah Ta'ala. Don't look at the dunya. Don't look at the wealth. Don't get caught up with that. We are here to establish the deen of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If there is neither injustice, nor do sins outnumber good deeds. Right? So he was making this dua. So Salman radiallahu anhu replied, Salman Farsi radiallahu anhu, he said, Islam is still brand new. By Allah, waters have been made to Muslims like lands. We're walking through this water, like as if to say we're walking on dry land. By the one in whose hand is Salman's soul, people will abandon Islam in large numbers, just like they entered Islam in large numbers. Salman Radinonu saying that Islam is still new meant that Islam remains alive and its adherents have still got strong iman, right? And the thing that makes them proud, not pride as in for your nafs, but the thing that makes them proud is their deen. That is their pride and joy, their deen. That is the sole purpose of their life is deen. In my own life, in my family's life, in the community's life, in the life of every person in the world. That's what they breathe for. Allah's deen. They lived and died for the sake of Islam. They called to it and they defended it. They gave their life to defend it. However, when it will grow old, this is what he meant by the statement of his, that when Islam will grow old, the latter generations will be Muslims by inheritance. My father was a Muslim, so I became a Muslim. Grandfather was Muslim, so I became Muslim. Not by choice. They wouldn't have accepted Islam. So they will not give Islam due importance in their lives, such that it shapes their sentiments and sensitivities. Rather, they will make worldly gains and supremacy their biggest goal. Deen will become a secondary issue in their lives. This is when people will abandon Islam in large numbers, just like they entered it in large numbers. I was trying to explain the same thing, I think it was Monday night when we were talking about Umrah, etc. That in old days, you know, money was hard to come by, traveling was not so easy, right? So people, you know, they saved penny. They sacrificed a certain luxury, put the money aside. Eventually, you know, they got the money together now to go for Hajj or to go for Umrah or whatever. So when they went, it was, you know, so much of toil behind this. And the only thing now they wanted was, hey, I must go to Baytullah, I must go to the Roza Mubarak, I need to change my life, I need to go and pour my heart out there to Allah Ta'ala. So it was a very, very spiritual journey. Today's time, now there's generations of wealth in the family, right? So now the youngster gets married, father says, put your name down for Hajj, you need to go for Hajj. He carries on his life as normal. He's partying, movie, yeah, there, dressing in a kuffar clothing, everything. Yeah, name came up, go. So there's no, you know, like a preparation for it. Now, Sahaba Naunum, they took deen like that. It was every, you know, drop of blood in their body was for the sake of Allah's deen. They embraced this deen and that was their life. Nothing, they were not worried about anything else. The deen was their life. Today, dunya has become our primary goal. The dunya has become our goal. Deen is by the way. Yesterday, one person phoned me and he said, Moana, no, I'm feeling very down. And we Muslims, we just carrying on with our life as normal. Other Muslims are being killed around the world and we still going on holiday and we still doing this and we still doing that. And other Muslims are being killed around the world. You know, is it right to feel this way? And, you know, what am I supposed to do to rectify the situation? So I told him, look, it's very good. You must feel pain. We Muslims are like one body. So if Muslims are suffering somewhere, you must feel the pain. And if you want to know what to do, then cut down your expenses, cut down especially our luxuries, our extravagances. Take that extra money, try to send it to those Muslims who are suffering, etc., etc. But then I told him, I said, see, bhai, don't get offended. I don't even know who the person was. I didn't even ask him what his name was, right? So I told him, look, I just want to ask you one question. I said, this pain you're feeling for the Muslims whose villages are being bombed and, you know, their lives are being lost, etc., right? Mothers, sisters, you know, women also, etc., right, the izzat is being taken in certain places. The pain you're feeling for them. Do you feel that pain in our own country when Muslims don't come for Fajr namaz? So are you feeling that pain? Are you feeling that pain when the Muslim youth are indulging, or whoever it is, youth, old people, whatever, are indulging in haram? You know, yesterday I had to go to Durban and so they needed to get one or two things, so we went to one or two shops that are generally frequented by females. So I was sitting in the car, and they went into the shop. The shop, mostly ladies go in the shop. But what is shocking, right? Even you don't want to see, you end up seeing. I mean, you have to drive, you have to look. As much as you try to protect your gaze, you will end up seeing, right? How our women are dressing, how our Muslim women are dressing today. Now, when Allah Ta'ala has given that lady the freedom of dressing in a modest manner, wearing her parda, wearing her cloak, covering her hair, covering her face. We don't have the problem like what they got in France. We don't have the problem like what they got in some of the Balkan regions, right? We don't have that problem. We have got freedom to practice our deen. Our ladies can dress up properly. By choice, intentionally, with spending a lot of money, they are dressing in a shameless manner. Is this not making Allah Ta'ala angry? Right? This makes Allah Ta'ala angry. Now tomorrow, if Allah Ta'ala unleashes an enemy, Allah Ta'ala unleashes an enemy on the ummah, and that enemy comes and rapes the Muslim woman. Now whose fault is it? Then at that time we want to say, those people are zanim, how can they do this, and look what they're doing to our mothers and sisters and all that. But when we as the men allowed the mothers and sisters, our own sisters, our own daughters, our own wives, we allowed them, go in the marketplace, walk on your own, no mahram, go talk to strange men, go work in the market, you got no reason to work, to go work, we want more money. We allowed all that. They can have friends, they're on social media, putting their pictures, everything. So who's taking their own? They're taking their own modesty. So now if Allah Ta'ala is to unleash an enemy that comes and does the most vile acts with them, whose fault is it? Whose fault is it? Then everybody suffers after that. The pious and the impious. Everybody suffers. Then on the day of Qiyamah, everybody will be resurrected according to their a'mal. But we sometimes bring destruction to ourselves. So all these Muslim girls that are going in the university or wherever, and they got boyfriends and they're going out with the boyfriends and all that, so they will not cry. They will not cry. Now the father and mother say, no, but we don't know that my daughter got boyfriend. You know what happens in the university. You're putting boys and girls together at that age. You know what's going to happen. Why is your daughter dressing up like a supermodel and going to university every morning? So you know what's going to happen over there. Right? But then we're fine with that. In the name of getting an education, in the name of making money, we're fine with that. But then when Allah Ta'ala gets so angry, and he unleashes an enemy, and now that enemy comes and does the most vile of things with those same Muslim women, then we sit and cry. We say, what are you doing to our Muslim women? Where's the human rights charter? Where's the UN now? Why they got double standards? No. Why we as Muslims got the double standards? We as Muslims got the double standards in our deen. People's hearts are in the control of Allah Ta'ala. What can people do? They can do nothing. When we are showing double standards with Allah Ta'ala, then Allah Ta'ala makes the people show double standards with us. It's our own fault. So the Muslims crossed the river safely without any loss or injury. None of them drowned in the river except a man from the Barik region called Gharqada. He slipped from his horse. Ka'ka bin Amr turned his horse towards him and caught him by the hand. Then he dragged him alongside till they crossed the river. The man, who was known to be very tough and serious, he said gratefully, he said, "Oh Ka'ka, our sisters are unable to give birth to the likes of you again." He was praising Ka'ka. So the man, he was Ka'ka's family also. He was also his family. The Persians were astounded at the daring river crossing by the Muslims. Yazdegerd, the emperor, he fled towards Hulwan, towards the snow-clad mountains beyond Baghdad. The Muslims entered the city without any resistance, and finally Sa'd radiallahu anhu entered the White Palace, reciting the Quranic verses, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم كم تركوا من جنات وعيون وزروع ومقام كريم ونعمة كانوا فيها فاكهين. How many of gardens and springs do they, meaning the Firauns of the world, the Firaun. This ayat are more referring to Firaun, but it's applicable to any enemy of Islam. Right? So how many of gardens and springs do they, meaning the Firauns and their people, left behind? Green crops, goodly places, and comforts of life wherein they used to take delight. Thus it was, and we made other people inherit them. So there it was, the Bani Israel inherited the wealth of the Coptics. Unlike conventional victors, the first thing he did, normally people are victorious, they start drinking, they start taking the izzat of women, they start looting, plundering. Sa'd radiallahu anhu, the first thing he did was he read 8 rakats. He read 8 rukus of Suratul Fath. Inna fatahna laka fatham mubina. He read 8 rukus from there. Right? Or 8 ayat, I'm not sure what they mean. I don't think there's 8 rukus in Suratul Fath. They say 8 units, the kitab says. So I don't know whether it's referring to 8 ayat of Suratul Fath. Right? The first troops to enter western Madain were the Shock Brigade, the first group, followed by Kharsa Brigade, led by the brothers Asim and Kaka, respectively. Here we'll stop there. We'll continue with this, inshallah. Allah Ta'ala give us tawfiq. Subhanallah wa bihamdihi. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdik. نشهد أن لا إله إلا أنت نستغفرك ونتوب إليك السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته